a cartoon that appeared in The Liberator in 1921. And it's, if you can read it, on the top there is Rebuilding Civilization. The woman on the left is branded communist. That's all that it says on her. The woman on the left, the woman on the right, rather, on the left, you have the profit system, parliament, and capitalism. And the caption at the bottom is, "You can't do it in those clothes, you know." For women in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, the left offered all kinds of opportunities for representations of Butch. There were representations of Butch in proletarian fiction all over the place. There were representations of Butch in magazines and newspapers and journals. And this really allowed for an expansive range of representations of women that oftentimes became literalized through representations of Butch lesbians. Not always. Sometimes a Butch is just a Butch, but at times it could actually open the door to actually making that connection explicit. On the other side of things, the National Marine Cooks and Stewards in the 1940s, which was a leftist union, it was the basically the men who worked on boats in these roles doing labor that was often traditionally associated with women's work, serving, cooking, and so on and so forth. It was understood by members of this union that it was largely a leftist, often black, but definitely interracial, and quite queer space. So Archie Green, who was a member of the Marine Cooks and Stewards in the 1940s, in an interview in an oral history in the 1990s, said the word was that the Marine Cooks and Stewards was a third red, a third black, and a third queer. I think that it probably overlapped a little more than that suggests. But anyway, the union was well recognized to be marked by interracialism, radicalism, and homosexuality, and the vernacular images that appeared in the union newspapers could be described as banal, playful, frivolous, fun, fussy, campy, and vaguely homoerotic, but especially as feminine. So I've just collected a few of them here, and there's many more. But you know, this if I had said that this was a pansy image from the same time period, from Broadway Brevities or something like that, I don't think it would have been surprising. All the cues are there, from the red lips to the, you know, lipstick and the jawline, and I don't even want to talk about the boat. But there are all kinds of images like this in the Marine Cooks and Stewards, and they just really give lie to the kind of idea of the masculine burly communist. And I see the membership card of the union and the flowers to the poor blushing Rose who's about to join the Marine Cooks and Stewards in the corner there. You know, the interracial solidarity, but at times it gets just a little overly chummy. It goes on and on. Anyway. You get the drift. The left did offer a space to challenge some of the gender normativity, and the idea of the lifestyle offered some kind of opportunity to think about a lifestyle outside of the strictures of the dominant codes of gender, which oftentimes in this time period, I think, neatly flowed into the accepted codes of sexuality. And in the Marine Cooks and Stewards, it certainly did openly. Okay, so the second vehicle or intersection that I want to think is around the axis of the language of anti-fascism. So the left's use of anti-fascism, which offered something more of what I referred to earlier as the broad tent, which you didn't really see in the Communist Party extended to homosexuality, did allow for representations to incorporate homosexuality into a broad anti-fascist critique. Okay, so there are many examples of this. Again, I'm selecting one. It's not because I only found one. But it's a good archetype here. I'm going to use an example from the 1934 anti-fascist novel, Those Who Perish, by Edward Dahlberg. This is one of the first novels to explicitly take on Hitler and the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany. This was published in 1934, so obviously this is a very early example of that. And it's an openly anti-fascist novel. In the novel, there's a remarkable scene that tenderly suggests homoerotic desire as producing a significant site of cross-class solidarity. Dahlberg includes a scene in which one of the few sympathetic characters in the novel, Eli Malamud, who is unemployed, broke, and 2 months behind on his rent, is taken to Child's cafeteria, and cafeteria, to anybody who's read Gay New York, is immediately a red flag, so to speak, by an ex-surgeon with tapering fluent fingers. Though Malamud rebuffs the open advances of the surgeon and hurries off, Dahlberg writes, quote, he walked and wept, sobbed to think that anyone could want him, could find in him a want and a need. He who was so needy and by now wantless, because it had become so futile to want anything at all, end quote. Framed within so explicitly anti-fascist a novel, this passage becomes remarkable. It's through a same-sex advance that a destitute character finds himself affirming his worthiness as a human being after having been rejected by the capitalist economy and the machinations of a cruel democracy that refuses to stand up to fascism in Europe. Tellingly, this is not the only scene involving homosexuality in the novel. Earlier, the strongly anti-Nazi character Moses Koch is mapped as a homosexual through his carrying of, quote, a paper edition of The Private Life of Oscar Wilde in, quote, the side pocket of his purple suit, and suggestively asking over lunch if Malamud had ever, quote, read Havelock Ellis, which again, end quote. Through a campy willingness to align the left with various forms of sexual and political refusal, and a scene wherein a disposable deviant awakens a sense of profound personal injury within an otherwise heartless and neglectful system, Dahlberg imagines an anti-fascism that repurposes the left to incorporate homosexual politics. Okay, so the third intersection here, and I still am on track to be done in time, so don't get nervous. The third intersection that I want to talk about is the intersection between the rhetoric around race that was being positioned as central to the Communist Party in the 1930s, and I do think that this is party-specific, that the Communist Party is particularly positioning themselves at the with race at the center at this moment. And how that impacts the way that people within the left are thinking about homosexuality. And there are two ways that this intersects. First, by defining prejudice broadly, so race prejudice being conceived broadly and incorporating prejudice against homosexuals. And secondly, by highlighting the repressive state as an enemy of both homosexuals and African Americans. And I'm going to give examples of each. So first, by defining prejudice broadly. On November 3rd, 1932, the San Francisco Spokesman, a black leftist newspaper founded a year earlier by recent Stanford economics graduate John Pittman and Robert Flippin, director of the Booker T. Washington Community Center, published an opinion piece addressing the problem of prejudice against homosexuals. Okay, this is a black communist newspaper in San Francisco in 1932. Though it was unusual for a pro-homosexual article to appear in even a radical newspaper, Pittman's editorial adapted the familiar fiery rhetoric, humanitarian logic, and outrage over oppression that were the hallmarks of leftist journalism in the 1930s to confront the prejudice and indignities faced by San Francisco's many homosexuals. The article was written in response to a group of young men who were jailed for appearing in drag in public. And I'm just going to read a couple quotes from the article. Quote, both race prejudice and the prejudice against homosexuals are bolstered and maintained by social taboo and law, Pittman writes. Both prejudices make life in this world a living hell for men and women whose only crime is that of being different from the majority. Both of these attitudes stink of bigotry and the deep-seated brutality of human nature. It is idle for Negroes to preach against race prejudice as long as they themselves practice another form of prejudice. The push for black self-determination advanced by the Communist Party informed Pittman's radical attack on prejudice against homosexuals. Pittman demanded audiences recognize the fate of African Americans and homosexuals as intertwined, but he also suggested how the discursive function of replacing different with normal pushed minorities of all kinds to the margin. On the second point of identifying homosexuals and African-Americans as joint enemies of the state, I'm going to breeze through here because I do want to finish in time for some Q&A with a couple of examples. The first is from James T. Farrell's 1934 short story, Just Boys. And in this novel, which is a story which is way too complicated to unpack here, but basically it involves a same-sex interracial affair that takes place within the homosexual subculture of Chicago. And it takes place within the black gay subculture of Chicago in the 1930s. James T. Farrell was a leftist writer. The 1930s, when this was written, was what Alan Wald has referred to as his revolutionary socialist years. And this story really ends up being a critique of the state. Essentially, what happens is there is, as was so often the case in stories involving homosexuality at this moment, a murder of one of the homosexuals at this party. And when the police show up, they say dismissively, and you have to, I apologize for language, but the officer that shows up to investigate the murder says dismissively, quote, "just a nigger fairy party, and one of the shines slashed a white pansy's throat. Christ, you should have seen them when we broke in, like a regiment of hysterical old women." Okay, so what I think happens here is that the narrative shifts to a critique of only racism or only homophobia to a critique that sees both as being part of the long arm of the state. So what ends up being critiqued here is the way that the state can't distinguish between the different folks that don't belong. Right, and that provides an opportunity for Farrell to imagine some kind of way in which homosexuals and homosexuals and African Americans can not only be seen as intersectional as happens throughout the story, but can also see themselves as having some kind of joint enterprise in opposing the long arm of the law, in opposing the way that the state doesn't actually recognize any of them as having any value. All right, I'm going to conclude here without reading that long quote that I was going to have. So we have plenty of time for Q&A. I just want to recap a little bit. What I've been trying to introduce here is a basic sketch of the research that I'm doing into homosexuality in the left in American culture. The research has particularly pushed me into an engagement with the cultural front, especially thinking about the ways deviance mobilized sexual political cultures in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. I want to conclude with a short vignette from H.T. Chang's The Hanging on Union Square, which I mentioned earlier from 1935, in which Chang suggests how the Communist Party's advocating solidarity could appeal to both sexual identities as well. In an important scene in the novel, two women, one clearly marked as a lesbian, one more conventionally straight, share an intimate kiss. Quote, "That wasn't so good. I didn't like it," the more straight woman declares. Quote, "But my dislike is just a matter of personal taste. It has nothing to do with our political opinions. We should form a united front always." Though a homosexual left united front was not always visible in the 20th century American culture, neither are historiographic claims suggesting such an alliance was impossible correct. In my project, I'm trying to recover all the hidden potential, baneful silence, and irresolvable contradictions that attend to radical political movements of the 20th century, through which lives could be changed, gates could be opened, and worlds were waiting to be won. There's much to be learned if we take time to listen to those shrieks, outcries, and fainting boys. Thanks. I didn't come in on time. Sorry.
Oh my God, it's 51:05. That's fantastic.
Think about how much we got done in that time.
It's incredible. I'm overwhelmed. So I'm just going to say one quick thing before we go to the Q&A, because I did forget to say that this is the first in our series of the American Conversation series with the theme of, I actually now can't remember what order I put it in, political culture, cultural politics, or maybe I reversed it. But
either way.
But so this was a great kind of introduction to that theme. Look for our notices because we'll have a few more events on that same theme over the course of the year.
Let me just say, I just want to say one more thing before we go to Q&A, and that is I meant to say it at the beginning. But Jordan Puglio, who's sitting over here, was my research assistant for a portion of this research. So she All deserves right. a shout out, and now she's an American Studies graduate student here at, UMass, at BU. So.
Are you going to call him?
I don't care.
You
do it.
Really?
I hate doing that.
Okay, I'll do it. Okay, Brooke.
Well, I have to say, Erin, the last time I saw you, I was in the hot seat, and you were here grilling me badly.
Oh, my God. Is that true?
But this was a much better talk than my talk.
Oh, please. Bring it on.
No, I'm very convinced by this, and I think this is really wonderful stuff. One of the things that I'm wondering about, though, is the conflation between sexual politics and labor politics. A lot of the reasons you gave for why homosexuals might be part of the left were sort of instrumental reasons. There were spatial overlaps in their urban communities. There were, you know, benefits. There was a kind of revolutionary allure, and there were a lot of compelling reasons you gave. But I'm wondering about the question of class politics and labor politics. For example, are there sort of the 1930s version of log cabin Republicans running around? People whose class interests actually are in opposition to their cultural politics. What do we do with J. Edgar Hoover? What do we do with homoerotic culture on the right, which is pretty strong on the far right as well? And so I'm just wondering, are these people in the left because they're gay, or are they in the left and also happen to be gay and find ways in order to sort of have those two separate politics happening at the same time? Is sexual politics really that aligned with labor politics, or, are they just sort of running in parallel?
It's a great question, and I don't feel like you're being, just suggest to me I must have been sort of warm and inviting in the question that I asked you. Really? God, I hate myself. So one thing that I'll say, I have a lot of answers to that, but one thing that I'll say is that I think that I would draw at least some kind of tentative distinction between working class politics and labor politics at this moment, because I think that there probably is a lot more overlap around working class politics than there is around labor. Now, within the cultural side of things, there are certainly representations of things like queer labor. So in the example of the Marine Cooks and Stewards, they're a particularly radical organization. And one of the oral histories that I didn't mention here, one of the former members of the union says, "We were all considered trash." And in a way, that lines up with this, what I'm talking about with deviants, that because they were considered to be really disposable workers, but you couldn't actually dispose of them because you were out at sea, that gave them a bit of license to sort of take advantage of the situation, and it provided opportunities for them to not care about the fact that they were also out at sea. So, their queerness was played out there. So that's a place where I think that the labor and the sexual politics did come into play. And, unfortunately, Alan Berube, who was doing a lot of really good work on that union, passed away before he could publish a lot of it. But I did go into his archive of his research in San Francisco, and it was quite daunting how much was there. But that was a place where I do think that the labor politics were inextricable from the sexual politics, that it was kind of the particular type of labor, the fact that the labor was marked as feminine labor, the fact that it was considered to be not manly work, actually did structure the possibility of the members being able to repurpose that. I would say that that is not as common on an organizational level as a broader way of thinking about working class and particularly proletarian identity. Okay, so the second way that I would answer that is by thinking about representations. There were a lot of labor novels that included homosexuals as central to the labor movement, and that was played out in sort of unpredictable ways. So, for example, William Rollins in that novel, The Shadow Before, when he has this character of Olson instigating the Gastonia strikes, he actually describes his mincing walk by comparing it to the machinery in the workplace. So there are these sort of representational ways in which the labor is being associated with sexuality, but I don't think it's happening in the most instrumental ways. Marine cooks and stewards is an example where it is. Most of the time, I don't think it's quite functioning that way. But I don't think that exactly means that it's gay, but also in on the left, partly because I just think those are aspects of identity that just become so totally intertwined for the individuals in the left. The left demands so much of these people. It demands so much of them that almost inevitably they find themselves in what I'm finding through letters and memoirs and things like that. They almost inevitably find themselves forced to reconcile them in some way, however tentative. It doesn't mean that they end up producing organizations out of that. But I think that it creates opportunities that shape the left in particular ways and do, you know, in some ways inform the organizations that come later. You know, the relationship between the Communist Party and Mattachine, for example, is oftentimes discussed as though it were pernicious. So Mattachine formed in spite of the Communist Party. You know, Harry Hay couldn't do both. You know, Harry Hay had to beg the Communist Party to kick him out. And they still wouldn't do it. They eventually agreed to give him this special classification without actually expelling him from the party. Okay, now as for the other side of your question, and you can have follow-ups too, you earned that.
Oh, nice.
There certainly were representations of homosexuality and fascism being aligned, and I would not want to suggest that what I'm saying is the only story to be told. I think that that in a way has become also more familiar. You know, there's a little bit more. You know, every time I give this talk, the fascism thing. You know, there's this sort of like vernacular. Not this exact talk. I've never given this, but there's a vernacular around of a vernacular understanding of the relationship between fascism and homosexuality that I think suggests a pervasiveness of that story that and the theories of Hitler being a repressed homosexual, all of these kinds of things, that the relationship between fascism and homosexuality is it's. It's another side of the story, so I don't think that homosexuality was only on the left. I think this is a compelling. I think that the left was one of the only places where homosexuality was being politicized.
Anita,
I wanted to ask this question because I have to go dinner. the examples of poetry that you offer are fascinating. But I was wondering whether you're interested in poetry that also has this kind of indirection about sort of homosexuality. Because I think in general that the poetry of kind of political engagement, poetry and politics. You know, who goes to what reading, who translates what poem, and so on. I mean, it develops, it's very, very important as a kind of tradition of leftist sort of activity and circulation. And I was wondering if there were poems that you discovered kind of played more with the language rather than being kind of overt, and whether those poems would count.
I feel like it's going to look like I planted you in the room when I answer this question, because the title of the book actually comes from a poem by John Malcolm Brennan that does exactly that. In fact, this is going to get even weirder. This is the book from 1942, and this is the poem, which I think does exactly what you're describing here. The poem is Waiting. What reason may the single heart employ when forward impervious it moves through savage time and science, through the joy of love's next meeting in a threatened space? What privilege is this whose tenure gives one anesthetic hour of relief while the air raid spattered signature displays a bitter artistry among the trees? Well, it's impossible to not see this as a poem in 1942 that relates to war, that relates to particularly anti-fascist war, which I think clearly relates to Brennan's connections to the left. I think you can easily make a jump here to see this as a poem that could be mined for also articulating things that relate to sexuality as well. When you actually go into the archive, that becomes less a matter of doing clever readings, and you actually see what changes over the drafts. And there's a lot more, a lot of the explicit material that's in the drafts gets slowly excised out as it moves through publishers and things like this. And, you know, I mean, and so there actually would be a much richer history of homosexuality on the left were it not for the fact that publishers were terrified to publish it. And that creeps up in interesting ways. Willard Motley, who I didn't get to talk about, but was an important black gay leftist novelist, actually has all of these things from his first novel pulled out, but it becomes a bestseller. So in his third novel, he puts him in. He just puts him in another novel instead, including one where he says, and again, pardon my language, but it's a quote from the novel where he has a gay character scream out, "Respect the opposite sex. Respect all the gay bitches." That's a quote. That was from a novel that was supposed to be published in 1947. He doesn't manage to publish it until two novels later in the 1950s. When he has enough cultural cachet to be able to get away with it, culture's changing and whatnot. So Brennan's like that too. So sometimes what seems veiled is actually much more explicit in earlier drafts. This isn't one of those cases. This is a case where I think that, yeah, that the sort of evocations that I get out of the language and whatnot lend itself to that kind of reading. Interesting.
Marilyn.
Aaron, you talked about your abiding interest in sites for the expression of, on the cultural politics side, of looking at poetry and literature and visual culture and for representations of the intersection of leftist politics and homosexuality. But I was wondering, given your also longstanding interest in popular music, whether you're incorporating, or you found any evidence of these representations in the music of the period?
Well, I would refer to it as a brief interest in popular music rather than longstanding. But I, you know, it's going to seem like an obvious answer, but certainly Mark Blitzstein is a figure who Cradle Will Rock, okay, has this one song in particular, which is about leafleting. And it's so campy, and it so clearly gets to this sort of sense of the intersectional spaces for leftist political activity and sexual cruising. And in the earliest cast recording, it's played for camp. And then as the recordings move further away from that moment, the first recording's actually produced in the 1930s, and then the next one's, I think, in the 50s or 60s, and then they put one out in the 80s or something, it becomes more of a gangster tough performance. So, but the whole thing is about leafleting under cover of night, and it's just ridiculous. I mean, the whole thing is like, my eyes is bulging, my pockets is, no, my eyes, I don't remember. my pockets is bulging with leaflets. And it's like, and that pause, I'm not doing that. That's in there. This pause, and that's just one example. It goes on. I can't call it to mind immediately. So that's one place where popular music fit. I wish I could say I were more more attuned to that side of things, but it hasn't been as central to this point. But Blitzstein is, you know, one place.
When you were talking about Brennan sending, you said he sent something home to his lover. You said Spain.
The book.
Yeah, Spain. Is this Auden's poem Spain, or there's another book? I don't know. There's a book called Spain. I don't know.
It could be. I mean, Brennan was actually friends with Auden.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't specify, so I don't want to necessarily say exactly what he was sending home.
So, I would assume that as a poet of the left and one working in the 30s and 40s, that Brennan, and I didn't know anything about him before coming here, and I certainly didn't know he was friends with Auden, but that he would have looked up to and been influenced greatly by W.H. Auden.
Oh, yeah.
And that the poem Waiting that you flashed up there sounds very much like an Auden poem in its diction, maybe a little less tortuous in its syntax than Auden would have been. But what I'm wondering here is, when you presented the initial poems by Brennan, as you presented them as to give us the idea that there was a kind of an exuberant exuberance about the coexistence that was very comfortable of his alternative sexuality and alternative politics, this left-leaning and also homosexual. And the last line in one of his poems there was when, or writing to his lover, when the two of us together shall lie at the end of time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm sure he must have been learning from Auden. If it were an Auden poem, there definitely would have been a pun on lie. We're lying together, but we're also lying to each other, and this isn't really working politically, sexually, in any given way. So, is there not ever any kind of ironic undercutting in that way? Brennan, who was, you said, friends with Auden, learning from Auden, in Brennan or in other poets like this that you're looking at, where there seems to be this absolute acceptance or exuberance about how well all of this works together, is there not any kind of ironic undercutting of that that you should see showing up?
It's a good question, and it's not something that I've particularly noticed, but that doesn't mean it's not there. It could just be something I should be attending to more closely. I mean, Auden is obviously, as you mentioned, an important figure here, and certainly Auden's connection to the Spanish Civil War and to Stephen Spender, and that obviously introduces this whole network of leftists, queer leftists, if you will, at the same moment. These folks were all in conversation with one another. They were all writing letters back and forth and whatnot, and oftentimes meeting one another. You know, and I would add to that, you know, Will Alto, who becomes friends with Auden and runs with that circle too. But that sort of level of the sort of literary borrowing of irony is not something I've discerned as being particularly central, but it's possible I just haven't picked up on it yet.
In the poem you flashed up there, it seemed to be straightforward to me that there was no pun on that.
Yeah.
Surprised me. Just I've been wondering what other examples you've seen.
Well, I think that Brennan was also, you know, Brennan is weird because he's one of the most committed leftists I've come across who is not really writing what would be comfortably described as proletarian verse. So even though he's defending the Nazi-Soviet pact, which again is a pretty hard left position to take in 1939, and he even writes essays on what is proletarian literature, his poetry is a lot more sort of indebted to traditions like surrealism, romanticism, things that don't seem like they're exactly what one would expect on the proletarian left, but at the same, or on the hard left, but at the same time, I think that he does feel this certain sense of, you know, this certain leftist call to be truthful or something like that. And so maybe that informs it, but, you know, I mean, there's some of the things I was quoting from were actually letters, not poems, and so, you know, I don't know. He was a romantic, you know. The worst moment in this whole research was when I opened up one of his letters to Kiemann Fryer, and a feather came out from the 1930s, and I almost threw up. It smelled so bad. But, you know, he was a romantic guy.
I was really curious, I think, in the Brennan example, but this kind of combination of a very leftist kind of utopian vision that's also very much, as you were saying, collapsed into a homosexual queer utopianism. I was curious if that's something that comes up a lot in a lot of literature looking at this. There's some type of, there is this horizon, we'll get over it, and not only is it a communist world, but it's also it's a homosexual world, or at least that's a strong component of what the new structure will be.
It comes up. It's a good question. It comes up, but I think that it's less common than the other side, which is the gritty social realism. And so you get like the letter from HHC of like, I will walk through the gate. You know, Brennan's always a romantic, so he's of course utopian. So you do get that to some extent. But I think that more often the representations that are offered during this time period tend to really emphasize more the gritty realities that sometimes give permission to represent things that might be considered impolitic or impolite. And that's the representational channel the left offers that tends to be taken up more often.
It seems like that actually seems maybe an issue that's a little contentious because it's so individualistic versus much more collectivist nature of the left during this period. Does that seem much more like what you're saying?
Does it seem, I'm sorry, say again?
Does it seem more that if there is a homosexual or queer utopia, it's much more individualistic?
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, it's very collective.
Yeah, I don't think, again, this is not... I sort of come at this by suggesting, isn't it crazy that people don't talk about the old left in the way they talk about the new left? But of course, coming out of it, the flip side is, of course they don't, because it didn't offer the same, you know, the same extent of material. So I think that, you know, I'm trying to have it both ways a little bit there. And so I don't think that you see as many articulations of that utopian vision at this moment. I think that does come later. But, you know, there are little fits and starts here and there. And I think that also, you know, the strictures of proletarian literature, particularly in the 1930s, really, they want a communist revolution at the end, but the rest of it, they want the meat. They want you to see the problems. They want you to feel the wounds. You know, and it's interesting what that does, because that means that, like, Michael Gold's Jews Without Money, when it's reissued in the 1960s in a pulp form, they just forget to leave out the communist revolution paragraphs. So they just leave off the last two paragraphs of the novel. So all you get is that gritty stuff, which is dirty and kind of dirty in both senses of the word. And so you can market it as a pulp novel. It's just the filth without the utopia. And that becomes, you know, and that becomes easy if you just have those last two paragraphs. And I think that was, you know, I mean, who was more devoted to actually following through on the strictures of the proletarian novel than Michael Gold? That was part of what, you know, it's different than the kind of socialist utopian novels that were a little earlier in that regard, I think. But you're right. It does make it a slightly more individualistic project.
Sarah,
picking up a little bit on that notion of possible collectivity or possible resistance. You talked in the beginning of your talk about the Communist Party's policy against degeneracy generally, but that there were, you know, part of the trajectory of the talk is about that there are individuals that resisted all along the way that policy on the grassroots level or a local level. And you mentioned Junius Scales, who I hadn't heard of, but you mentioned that he was Southern. And I was wondering if you noticed in your research these, in terms of the people that resisted, if there actually was a regional component to that resistance, or are there particular pockets where people tended to be more resistant to the policy? Are they where we would expect, or is it more of an individual resistance that you're seeing?
Well, for one thing, it's hard to get into the archives that could answer those questions most clearly, which would be two things. The disciplinary records of the Communist Party, which actually Bettina Aptecker, who's doing research on that side of this story, she's actually gotten access because of the obvious reasons. She's gotten access to those records, and so she's actually going to be able to tell that side of the story, which is great, and we've presented our work together.
And it's not obvious to everybody.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bettina Aptecker,
her father
was a major theoretician in the Communist Party. Sorry.
It was obvious to me.
Okay, it's like when my students say something.
The records of the CPUSA are also a microphone. I look at them. You can look at
yeah, but the disciplinary records.
They're not in those?
Right. Yeah, they're very, very, very careful about releasing the disciplinary. There's some, but most of them are, you know, Bettina's there in actual microfilm.
Where
and
are
she had to
physically?
Get special, NYU. Yeah, the party. But then there's also records in Moscow that that's just, the climate is just not right for telling that story right now. But hopefully someday it will be.
Well, I also heard, though, that the New York CP sent all their records over to Moscow.
Yeah.
And then after, you know, 1989, then the Library of Congress bought them.
Yeah, there's some records at the Library of Congress. I mean, they are here and there.
And there's a lot about culture. I know somebody was working on all the murals and things like that that Hugo Gellert and a lot of different artists were that are in those records.
Did I break your heart with that William Gropper cartoon, Pat?
No, I've seen it.
Okay, good. So yeah, I mean, to get to the region, to get back to the regional thing for 1 second, you know, most of what I found has not been regional specific, but it has been more urban centered, and so. I haven't found a lot of actual, you know, it's an interdisciplinary project, so I'm looking at a lot more than just archives of actual organizations, but most of what I found in that regard has been urban spaces.
Makes sense.
Which is sort of counter to a lot of the new historiography on sexuality, which has moved into rural spaces, mm-hmm. But what can you do?
Well, urban spaces and the sea.
And the sea, that's
sea.
Right.
Sea.
I'm
that's
part
right.
of the new maritime studies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you again. Join us right, for our reception and talk some more to Aaron.
Like, you know, you have to save something for a dinner conversation.
You feel like you're in charge of making sure it goes smoothly. Yeah.